Oilers. We're the Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers number one. Yes, we're the Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers number one.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to Battle Red Radio. I'm at Weston tonight. I'm talking to myself to empty out the mailbag because we had some internal problems here for the weekend preview show. Our good friend Taylor is sick with something. I'm guessing COVID, but I think he's probably too lazy to actually go out and get tested. But he came down with something, and so he's unable to talk or hold a long conversation. And even though, like, we record the show remotely now because we live in different cities, again, I still, you know, it's a scary thing, and I still wouldn't feel comfortable talking to him even through the computer as a result of it. But we'll text each other and get our picks as we continue the very stupid tradition of making picks against each other and then buying each other dinner, which I always end up getting, like, you know, 8 months after the Super Bowl, after a lot of nickel and diming and arguing about it. But over the past, you know, 2 or 3 weeks, I've accumulated, you know, a significant number of questions from everybody. And it's one of those things where we've had really good guests on the show lately, and there's only so much, you know, we can talk about. And like, talking to people for the first time too, we kind of get in these, like, longer, you know, conversations about where I get a better idea of people's view of the team, their feelings of the team. And so whenever you have, like, an hour and a half conversation that, you know, hits on a wide scope of topics, it's been difficult to get to some of the listener questions sometimes. And so I always want to make sure I get to them, even if it is, you know, me sitting here and talking to myself, because these are the things that, you know, we do in a down and bad season where the content is what matters more so than the football team sometimes. Also, I would like to apologize to everybody who follows the Twitter clips I post every week. I was wrong about something this week whenever I posted the blitz pickup on Tyus Howard giving up a sack, and it turns out that Lane Taylor was the culprit. He slided, you know, one gap over to the right, so I thought it was like a full slide coverage where, you know, they're going A, B, and then with Rex Burkhead looking, you know, inside out to pick out the edge defender. And that didn't make much sense looking at it again, just because you rather have Burkhead pick up the defensive end than, you know, than Tyus Howard. You rather have Burkhead pick up the linebacker instead of the defensive end. And so it turned out just being like a half slide protection where they're sliding one gap to the right. It was big on the left, and Lane Taylor didn't get the memo, and he went to the A gap and it let create a free blitzer. So I was wrong on that. I'm sorry, Titus. I'm sorry. And I'm sorry for all of you who, you know, watched that clip and thought that, and I provide disinformation to you. It's not a good thing, and you know, I'm dumb, but like I said, I'm not obstinate, and I always, like, you know, pivot when new information comes around or change my mind whenever something warrants it. You know, it's one of those things where, like, it's a short season away because the sample size is small, but it's a long season. There's always, you know, new things that come up time and time again. So this weekend, the Texans play the Indianapolis Colts, and, you know, I think it's one of those games that's going to be kind of brutal just because the Texans have a terrible run defense. They're, you know, bottom of the league in yards attempt allowed and run defense DVOA, and, you know, they've been doing these, like, weird run fits too where they have their defensive line slant away from the strong side of the, or slant to the strong side of the formation, and have the play side linebacker loop back to the other side of the formation to, like, become the cutback defender and also, like, clean up things to the interior of the field. And it really just is able to, like, hide this defender and ensure that he's unblocked. It worked against Miami because the Dolphins have an atrocious run offense like they do every year, where they have one, you know, NFL caliber offensive lineman on their entire offensive line right now. And that's why Neville Hewitt had such a good game that week, where he was given a lot of one-versus-one tackle opportunities. But it really didn't work at all against Tennessee. The Titans are just a, you know, really good outside zone team. And, you know, even without Derrick Henry out there, they still have an offensive line that's great blocking that scheme. And they crushed Houston that first half just because of those weird run fits they were using. Whenever they just played a more traditional one-gap scheme in the second half, they were much better at stopping the run. And, you know, it also helps whenever Ryan Tannehill's having to throw, you know, 40-plus passes in that game too. And then last week, it was the same thing with the Jets also. They were, you know, running that same sort of run fits and really kind of getting chewed up by the outside zone and horizontal run game, especially whenever your linebacker is, like, going running to the opposite side of the play over and over again. And, you know, that Jets team, that was kind of the biggest thing they did differently in that second half, or after, I guess, their, like, first two bad drives, is that they switched to a more horizontal offense, and they really just, like, ran stretch run plays and outside zone over and over again and really devoured Houston's front by doing so. And so this week I expect something similar against the Colts, where, like, Jonathan Taylor could run for 200-plus yards. He could have, you know, three or four touchdowns. I mean, none of that is off the table at all. And the Colts' offensive line is finally healthy, and they've gotten the combination, not that I want, but that they want. Like, I'd still rather watch Julian Davenport out there than Eric Fisher, but, you know, I'm not the god of this world, and I'm just a mere spectator in it. And, you know, it's been really good, like you kind of expect with the Colts' offensive line, especially from, you know, interior up to Brain Smith, and getting Quentin Nelson and Smith back were, you know, enormous for that Colts team. But yeah, I mean, like, Carson Wentz is probably going to have a game where he may only throw the ball like 18 times and nine of those will go to T.Y. Hilton, and T.Y. Hilton will have, you know, 150 receiving yards. It's going to be a mess. And, like, Wentz will throw a lot of RPOs and, like, quick slants. I'm sure he'll draw a couple of defensive pass interference penalties. I think they'll have some problems throwing the ball downfield just because Justin Reed is, you know, solidifies that deep middle safety, and he's good taking away the deep passing game over there. And they won't get the same opportunities that the Jets had last week with Terrence Brooks being out there, where there was just a huge hole in the zone between Desmond King and Brooks, you know, time and time again. And the Texans, like, you know, their front is, I think, you know, fine. You know, I think the interior of the defense has been the strength of it with Lopez, Blacklock, and Malik Collins there. But, like, they're still going to have problems against this Colts offensive line generating a lot of pressure. You know, Grenard had a big game against the Colts earlier this year by lining up as a 6-eye and taking advantage of Mo Alie-Cox and some of the other tight ends in pass protection. And, you know, this week, that this defense kind of presents, like, the same similar opportunity, especially when the Colts play, you know, play action. But I still think they're going to struggle to, you know, get pressure in this game, and really they won't even have that many chances to do so because Wentz probably won't throw the ball a whole lot too. I would also like to see, you know, the terrifying thing about the Texans pass rush also is they blitz a lot sometimes now, or they've at least been, like, trying to, and they camouflage it by showing double A gap pressure and rolling into different coverages. And it's so funny that it took, you know, Lovie Smith like 6 weeks to understand, hey, you can't just show a cover two shell pre-snap and then just run cover two over and over again. And I don't know if it was just because of a shortened training camp and off-season that it took some time for them to, like, be able to have the defense, with so many new players too, be able to run the defense like an NFL caliber, like, sort of system right away. And it took, you know, weeks to add new coverages and new ideas to it. But whatever reason, it's funny that it took 7 weeks for, you know, Smith to do things like show double A gap pressure and then roll to cover two, or show cover three and, you know, end up playing man coverage and bring some sort of blitz. And they've actually started camouflaging some things as well. And it helped, you know, like, I think it created that big turnover against Tennessee with the Grizer Hill interception. But, you know, it's like something that's very elementary that they started doing kind of recently. And the other thing I want to talk about, Lovie Smith's defense, and I mentioned it, you know, earlier this week on the Cap and Trade podcast I did with, you know, Texans Cap, which you should, you know, check out and subscribe to his podcast. He does a good job with it. And they do, like, a cool, like, Twitter Spaces thing where you can listen live and ask questions, you know, through, like, your voice as well, too, and call in a way, like a typical radio show. But I just don't think, like, the pass defense is that good. I think it's extremely overrated. I think the problem is getting stops. I think there's a lot of holes in their zone coverage. They really can't play man coverage at all. They've just been fortunate with the turnovers, you know, like Zach Wilson's backflip interception, or the tight ends back up wide receivers, you know, stopping their route too early, or, you know, there's just, I mean, even like that Miami game too, there is some fluky interceptions in that one. And also, like, playing Jacoby Brissett and not playing some of the better quarterbacks in the league has helped out also. Or, like, Josh Allen overthrowing you know, his receiver and throwing right to Lonnie Johnson Jr. And so those sort of things have been available. And so I don't really think a lot of it's just been scheme. I think it's just been kind of luck, and it's fluky. And that's a lot of what happens with turnovers, where the Texans were one of the worst teams in the NFL creating turnovers last year. They only had three interceptions, one of which was a J.J. Watt pick six on Thanksgiving Day. And, you know, now here we are, and they're forcing turnovers. And I don't really think it's like really all, like, it means a whole lot. I don't think it's like an indictment of, you know, this job that Lovie Smith has done, or, you know, the Texans defense being particularly good. And I asked Rivers if he could pull up the turnover stats or the Texans defense with and without turnovers. And they were 10th with turnovers and 21st without them, you know. And like, again, like a play-by-play defense, it really hasn't been that good. But yeah, I'm just expecting, you know, the Colts to hold the Texans to like less than 3 yards a carry, and for the Texans to have a lot of problems stopping the run. And this should be like a pretty fast game, but I'm expecting the Colts to win like, you know, 30-13 or something along those lines. So with that being said, let's get to some of these listener questions. The first is from Derrill Texan, T-E-X-S-O-N, as you know, in the comment section of Ballrat blog for years and years. A great guy, it's always interesting to see, to read his comments, and you know, he watches the entire league as well too. You know, it's not just a myopic Texan sort of thing. But we stream the Brand Scott podcast on StreamYard earlier this week, and kind of did it like, you know, sneaky out of nowhere. And it just because he didn't have Skype, so we recorded it live like that. And you know, I may start just streaming them as well too. Just being an adult man, I feel silly, you know, streaming. I think it's something for, you know, kids and children to do. But I think people like it now, so we may do it again this week whenever we do the Colts review. So anyways, his question is, okay, why don't you talk about all the guys who leave and show much more than we saw from them than for the Texans? I can't watch a game in the NFL without hearing from them. Tonight, I keep hearing DeAndre Carter make catch after catch. Yeah, the DeAndre Carter thing is one of the the worst developments of this cursed season, where he's caught touchdown passes in three straight games previously. He returned a kickoff return for a touchdown. I don't think he's fumbled yet this year as well, too. He has fumbled zero times, and he's actually recovered a fumble, which is incredible in its own right. But yeah, he had touchdown against Denver, Tampa, Carolina, and then against Seattle, he had four catches on five targets for 42 yards. It's insane that him with his five total touchdowns this year, It's insane that him with his four total touchdowns this year has more receiving touchdowns than Brandon Cooks does. And, you know, it really is a cursed season. I think the Titans, though, are my, you know, favorite ex-Texans team, just because it's a wide variety of guys, and Mike Vrabel loves doing that for whatever reason. And the other thing that's funny about it, every time I go through them, I always forget somebody, but it's Kendall Lamb, Ben Jones, David Questenberry, Deontay Foreman, Dylan Cole, Michael Pruitt, and I know I'm missing some other people as well too. But it's a long list. It's a whole litany of, you know, former Texans playing there for the Tennessee Titans, and you know, Mike Vrabel loves them. And it's gonna happen. Like, I'm already ready for Max Sharping to sign with the Titans either, you know, the next year if he gets cut, or, you know, a year after that, after his rookie contract ends, and he ends up becoming like a competent outside zone blocker and replaces Roger Saffold. It would be, you know, the most Texans thing of all time to ever happen. But yeah, it's one of those things, like with Bill O'Brien, where, you know, he's a bad head coach. A lot of the players that he had here were, you know, put in like a boring scheme and kind of like moved around over the place because of versatility, and they've gone to other teams who are better coached and just are able to limit their role and have more success in League 2. And so, yeah, like, even if you miss the Texans of old from like 3 or 4 years ago, they're still out there, you know, making plays and doing things for other teams. But the DeAndre Carter one just makes me sick every time I think about it. The next question is from Daniel Benavides, and he's asked this question a few times before, and I have had trouble, you know, getting to it, just from, again, not being able to get to a lot of these listener questions here and there. But he asked if 9-8 makes the postseason this year. And, you know, looking at it, This would actually be a good time to pull off the playoff picture as well, too. But looking at it here in the AFC, you have the Patriots and Bills in the AFC East, with the Patriots at 8-4 and the Bills at 7-4. In the North, you have Baltimore, Cincy, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Baltimore 8-3, Cincy 7-4, Cleveland 6-6, Pittsburgh 5-5-1. The South, you have Tennessee 8-4, Indy at 6-6. And then the West is all jumbled up with the Chiefs leading at 7-4, where they're actually playing for the division lead this week whenever the Chiefs and Broncos finally play each other, with Kansas City at 7-4 and Denver at 6-5. So in this strange season, we have the Ravens with the 1 seed 8-3. Even though they can't beat a team by more than, you know, one score with the injuries and everything else, they've been the good bad team where they've rid their way through, you know, the wins they've had. But it would be Baltimore, Chargers in the, or the Baltimore would be off and the Chargers would be the 7 seed. It would be Chargers Patriots as the 2-7 matchup. Again, the Patriots won earlier this year because of a, you know, pick six whenever Herbert and the flat receiver were on the same page, and the Chargers have one of the worst run defenses in football, and the Patriots really were able to grind them out. The other game would be the Titans with a 3 seed against the Bills as a 6 seed, and that Monday Night Football game earlier this year was my favorite game I've watched so far this year. I mean, it had everything I love, like silly Titans plays like that Julio Jones helmet donk reception, the Josh Allen getting stopped on 2 quarterback sneaks, and him even slipping at the end of the game. He had some outrageous throws on the run, too. That touchdown Stephon Diggs was, you know, absurd. And it also, you know, ended in a very silly way, like I mentioned, with Allen slipping like that. And they had, like, that enormous Derrick Henry run. And so I think that'd be that's the AFC Championship game I like to see. But, yeah, that'd be a great matchup. And 4 or 5 would be Kansas City, Cincinnati, where you have a Bengals team that can run the ball well, and them having a good outside zone offense is one of the silliest things that has happened this season, too. So in the hunt are the Raiders at 6-5, Denver at 6-5, the Colts at 6-6, the Steelers at 5-5-1, and the Browns at 6-6. And so, I mean, I don't think 9-8 will get you in, even though everybody's so jumbled together. But you expect with December here, which is like the biggest time of the year for football, whenever you kind of these like teams kind of separate from the pack. I wouldn't think 9-8 gets in. I think you have to win 10 games, especially in, you know, 17 games scheduled to get it. But I would expect Indy to drop off. I just don't think they're very good, and Wentz isn't very good. Same thing with Cleveland, same thing with Pittsburgh. And I would also, the West is so weird right now. I would expect Vegas to drop off. Even the Chargers, too, just because of how bad their offense is. And how, like, Denver has, like, a great pass defense at a minimum. So, I don't know. I don't think 9-8 does it, but I think it will take at least 10 wins to get in the postseason this year. So our next question is from @ConfusedLefty, and he asks, why must we always establish to run on third down? You know, that Texans game against the Jets, there's a couple of, you know, silly play calls, like the handoff to Rex Burkhead at the end of the game on their game-tying drive attempt, where they ran like a zone read play with Brevin Jordan running on the flat. And the defensive end crashed down, and for whatever reason, Tyrod Taylor, you know, decided not to keep on that one. And when it really seemed like a very simple read, there was, of course, the jet sweep on the end of half drive. And, you know, this is Rex Burkhead's team now, and he's going to get, you know, the majority of the carries, which is, you know, so funny that it's 2021. And, you know, Rex Burkhead's a running back number one at this point in the season. With David Johnson, you know, hobbled and limping, and, you know, really not even looking like he wants to run the ball anymore, rather just be a wide receiver at this portion of the year. But I don't know. And I also think the established to run stuff, I think, like, any conversation about the run game isn't, you know, very interesting. There's a lot of Twitter conversation, you know, this week about some PFF nerd wrote about how, like, running's not important. Like, your running is, I mean, throwing the ball is a more efficient play, but, you know, there are good aspects about running the football, whether it's controlling the down distance or the tempo of the game or wearing down your opponent or, you know, getting the physicality needed in football, which is a, you know, physical violent sport. I think there are good aspects of the run game, but I think it's not as efficient as throwing the ball, of course, but, you know, you don't have to have a good run game to be a good football team, but the teams that lack elite quarterback play, you know, if you can win football games by having a great rushing attack that complements your passing attack, though. And it just really kind of depends on your personnel, too. But it's one of those conversations that pops up at least once a year, and every single time I'm not interested in it at all whatsoever. But the Texans are a team that runs the ball a lot because they have a bad quarterback. When you have a bad quarterback, that's what you're stuck with doing. And you know how often they run also, like, it allows them to be more funky with their play action passes. And you know, even though they can't run the ball well, at least like the threat or the possibility they're probably going to run it does open up some other things too. His next question is, have we reached the bottom yet? And you know, as we know, there is no bottom at all. Things can always get worse. They can always get terrible, even more so than they are. There's always another level to it. And so, like, as bad as it is with two wins at this point, with the talent issues, the youth issues, and you know, and some of the decisions that Kassira made this offseason, and the Watson stuff, it can always get worse. And I think probably the worst thing that could happen is to the Texans, you know, blow the Watson thing, or if Watson gets suspended long-term before they can trade him. And that's also in the realm of possibilities. There is no, you know, closed reality to how stupid things can get. So yeah, if you think it's as bad as it gets, it can always get worse. The next question here is from at Marvin Bernard 4. Is Dylan Thompson stealing money? What does he do as a character coach? Thought he was there to quell disagreements, etc. And this, of course, is in reference to, you know, Justin Reed and him sitting out and getting an inactive call for having disagreement with the teammate. And you're talking to Brandon Scott last week, it didn't seem like it was anything, you know, off the record that he heard. It didn't seem like it was anything that was like extraordinary. You know, it wasn't like he was missing team practices or walkthroughs, or they were swung at a guy, or, you know, was hung over to practice or something like that. It was just a disagreement he had with a player or some on the coaching staff, and that's how it's handled. And David Coley said in the radio show it was a very easy decision to make. And you know, they missed him last week with how bad their safety play was with Terrence Brooks. But I don't know much about, you know, Dylan Thomas and what he does. I know he's a Jack Easterby before, you know, in waiting, or he's Jack Easterby's like protege, where he's there to make sure players are happy and they have what they need. And the only thing I've ever heard about him so far this year was a clip that Rivers McCown posted talking about Brevin Jordan on the podium as talking about Dylan Thompson. He said he's been very helpful as like for all the rookies, that he's there to like help them get used to being a pro athlete and everything that comes along with that. And so, you know, maybe there's some merit to him. I think, you know, given the Easterby, like, that football is very, like, there's a lot of religion in football. There's a lot of character stuff in football. You know, football is more than football. There's always like an extent of it. Like, there is a good aspect of having somebody like that around, but it's just whenever somebody like that runs the football operations and becomes your general manager and has the level of control that he has, where we've had so many bad and dumb decisions take place with him there, that it kind of lends itself to, it's too much, you know, like it's not the end all be all for a good football team. And I think the culture and character stuff has gone, you know, too far. Instead of just like getting good football players, they want a football player that matches this ideal that they have. But I mean, as far as Thompson goes, you know, the only thing I've heard from him was a nice thing from Brevin Jordan. So I don't know, maybe he's a good thing to have. The next question is from at Confused Lefty, and he asks, who's the most to blame for the garbage play calling in the Texans Jets game? And you know, it's Tim Kelly. He's been really bad aside from that Kasser motion screen that he had against the Cleveland Browns in week 2, and you're using like rub concepts out of the pistol to attack the Jaguars in man coverage, who are like the only team coached worse than the Texans are the Jaguars as well. But I mean, just some of the stuff, like the run game design, the fact they didn't attack cover 4 and cover 7 very much at all against a team that runs a lot of cover 4 and cover 7 was absurd. There's really like only 3 cover 4, cover 7 beaters that they ran against the Jets, and like they were showing the shells too. Like, you could line up and see, like, hey, this is what they're doing. And they did a lot of stuff where Ashton Davis would come down, play the robber position, and you kind of turn like cover 4 and 2, you know, cover 3 as a result of that, take away, you know, intermediate crossing stuff for Taylor. And that's why his passing chart didn't have any throws at all to the middle of the field. It's because Ashton Davis came down as the runner and took away those throws. So I just don't, like, I don't know what he's doing. And like, the Jets didn't just like change up that in the second half. They were doing it all game, and they didn't have an adjustment for it. They have an answer for it. And, you know, they had the two deep throws they schemed open, and they had that miss to Danny Amendola on the out route. But aside from that, you know, they just didn't scheme the throws they needed to. You know, they had the same problems with the blitz as well in that game, as we saw with the Quincy Williams sack. And also this one of the sacks that Fadu Kazi had came from a slot corner sack or a cornerback blitz where David Johnson didn't pick it up correctly. And, you know, you can't even see the hot route on some of those pass rushes too, where you're playing cover one and they're running isolation routes and nobody can get open because Amendola isn't good and Chris Conley isn't good. And, you know, Brevin Jordan has problems being man coverage, and, you know, same thing with Farrell Brown, and there's just so many other issues too. But I think we're at the point where, like, yeah, the talent's, you know, an issue, but, you know, Tim Kelly's done an awful job putting, you know, teams in a position to, or players in a position to make plays as well. The next question is from @_necrodank_. If God's not real, how do you explain David Coley being 2-1 in the division? Well, I think the thing here is that God is real, and that's a sign of his majesty with the Texans' 2-1 division record. And, you know, thankfully they get another game against the Jags. They get another game against the Titans, and they'll probably lose the Colts this week to put them at 500. But yeah, they'll probably finish 3-3 in the division, and their only wins this year may end up being in the division, which, like, just keeps continuing to show how beautiful and stupid the AFC South is. Like, if you love stupid football, the AFC South is, when you're here, your family for it. So the next question is from @ConfusedLefty. He had a few of them. He said, this was a Thanksgiving Day question. Since it's the day to be grateful and thankful, what's the most grateful thing we have to be thankful for? From Jack Easterby and Cal McNair. I don't know. I guess the fact that Cal McNair spends money on players and he opens up his pocketbook and he's not cheap by any means. And, like, that's what you want from an owner. You don't want to hear anything about him. You don't want to know much about him. But you want him to, like, do things for the community. You want him to spend money. And, you know, Cal McNair has done exactly that. As far as Easterby goes, I don't know. Like, I don't know. I guess he brought Dylan Thompson here, and Dylan Thompson made Brevin Jordan happy, and, you know, that's a good thing. His next question is, what got you into watching Texans football as a franchise, and did you have a team before them in the expansion draft? So when the Texans came to be, I was a fat 12-year-old or 13-year-old or whatever it was, and I was a fan of a couple of different teams. You know, I always enjoyed watching football with my father. But, like, I love Brett Favre. When I was, like, 6 years old, I got Brett Favre jersey for Christmas. I like playing quarterback club a lot in N64 because Brett Favre was on the cover. And then I really fell in love with the Rams because I love Marshall Faulk and Muhammad as their kick returner, and Hull and Bruce and Prohl and Orlando Pace and the whole, you know, group of guys. And, I mean, I just love Marshall Faulk more than anything. He was a wide receiver and a running back. His mouthpiece was really cool. The uniforms were awesome in the dome, just like that dark blue and gold. It didn't look as good as, like, the older school ones, but I think it fit the kind of, like, the lighting in the dome very well too. And I don't know, I love Marshall Faulk. I love that team. And I still couldn't believe it whenever I was a child, whenever they lost that Super Bowl to the Patriots too. It was insane to me. They just, like, took away Marshall Faulk in the flat, and then the Rams have an answer from that. So whenever the Texans came around, I didn't have a team necessarily. You know, I was teamless, and I've, like, wanted to be, like, a fan of, like, one team to really kind of love instead of kind of bouncing around as things came to be. And then whenever the Texans came around, it was kind of it for me. I remember playing, I think, Madden 01 with Dante Culpepper on the cover. And after the first season was over, I guess it may have been Madden 2000. Yeah, I guess it was Madden 2000, Dante Culpepper on the cover. And after the first season of play, the Texans came in as an expansion team. And I was able to, went quickly ahead to play with them and, you know, did everything I could to win a Super Bowl pretty fast. I guess it was Madden 02 then. I guess I was wrong. But whenever I remember, I have a very vivid memory of winning the Super Bowl with the Texans against the Seahawks and Sean King at quarterback. And I was drinking a smoothie at the time. It's in this, like, black, you know, stinky chair. And it was a very important moment in my life to win a Super Bowl with the Texans. And the expansion draft thing was cool too and all that. So that's what got me into that team. And I've been watching them every Sunday ever since, you know. No matter what's going on, I'm there watching our stupid football team. So I remember a lot of this stuff from the old days. I remember watching the games. I just don't remember a whole lot from the games themselves. And it was like a light didn't really turn on when it came to watching the Texans until probably like 08, 09, something like that. I don't know. It's all been very dumb. And that's how I became a fan of this football team. And I started writing for the website, I guess, for the 14 season or the 13 season, that 2-14 mess. And I've enjoyed it, you know, ever since. The writing part's been a lot of fun, sending the podcast and everything else too. And it has enriched the experience of watching the team itself. His last question was, why did the NFL side punish everyone Thanksgiving with Bears and Lions? And, you know, really, after talking to Chris Perfitt last year about the Lions on Thanksgiving, I really kind of changed my tune about the Lions on Thanksgiving being a bad thing. And his words, to paraphrase, were, it's the only thing we got, you know? Just let us have this. It's the only thing we have. And it really is, you know, as bad as the Lions have been for, you know, my entire life, they at least are always playing on Thanksgiving. They always have that game to look forward to, and it's their own personal Super Bowl. It's their own, you know, it's probably the highlight of being a Lions fan year in and year out. And this game last year was very sad to watch them, watch Swift get hurt and watch that penalty to be able to give the Bears a first down where they were able to just kneel the clock out from there. And Dan Campbell was someone so bad, and I feel so bad that he can't win a game this year. So our next question is from at found of HOU Sports. Is the light turning on for Tyus Howard left guard? This one was asked a while back ago, of course. And I think the biggest thing about Tyus Howard lately is I think like a light's come on, like from a tenacity aspect. He's been a lot meaner. He's been a lot stronger. He's been a lot tougher. Whatever word you want to use it. He's been just kind of trying to kick ass in the run game a lot more now. Or he's really, you know, looking to finish his blocks and drive guys off the ball and just playing a lot more like strength and anger. And, you know, he's been lacking that, especially the guard position. And we saw it some more last week in that Jets game where he had some really nice pass sets, aside from getting that sack to Ronald Blair, you know, wherever he got beat with that bull rush. Aside from that, though, like he's a good pass protecting left tackle, and he was a good pass protecting right tackle year before that. So I am hoping that maybe we could see him, they'll leave him there, he can stay at left tackle, and then they could trade Laremy Tunsil for an early second round or late first round pick next year, and then be able to, you know, get another draft pick out of Tunsil and just leave Howard at that spot where, you know, he's better off. His next question is, would you bring back most of the defensive line considering the steady improvement? For me, it's Grenard, it's Lopez, it's Blacklock, and it's Collins, and then everybody else can kind of, you know, beat it. You know, DeMarcus Walker is pretty much playing defensive end, which is kind of funny, you know, and like he's had, I wouldn't say he's had some good pass rushes, but he has a good motor. He's able to play his way into some production too. I don't think Jacob Martin's good. You know, he had the sack last week because he had that inside rip following the puller when they were selling play action. I have no idea at all why Fant, you know, took a slide step left instead of, you know, pretty much turn the gate where you take a slide step to the inside gap to make sure you protect it. And then with a guy pulling, like, that should be expected. And then from there, you open the gate to be able to wall up that gap and protect the inside gap from the inside moves at all. And I don't know why he took the foot he did, the steps he did, but it's like, you know, Martin read the pull, ripped inside, got the sack. But, like, aside from that, all he does is just chop rip. And it works one out of, you know, 35 times. And, you know, the time it works, he has good closing speed, and he's able to turn, you know, his one good pass rush move into a sack because of it. And that's why he has the sack numbers he has, is that whenever he hits, he has the speed to close on the quarterback from there. But yeah, like, you know, he's the Chris Davis of pass rushers. He gets one hit out of every, you know, 40 at-bats and ends up being a home run. And because it's a home run, he's able to keep giving the stops from there. But he's also one of the worst run defenders you'll ever see. He's undersized. He should be playing a 3-4 defense. I also expect for him to go to Carolina next year. Potentially where he can reunite with Matt Rhule at Tennessee and kind of fill in Hassan Reddick's spot where he's going to get a big contract somewhere after having a really great year this year as well too. But, I mean, Lopez has made plays that you don't see from a rookie nose tackle. He's really smart. He sees his reads really quickly, sees his keys quickly. He understands his hands and pad level well, and he's strong, and, like, he can actually clear the interior too and has a little bit of pass rushing juice. And Blacklock had the best game of his career against Tennessee. He was, you know, he had the two big dumb mistakes, and he had some problems against the outside zone game about, you know, where to be and that sort of thing. But, like, this has been a better year for Blacklock, and Collins is a honey bear. You know, he spins around the interior. He has that half spin. He has a good rip, a good chop swim as well, too. And I think, like, with him, he may have played himself out of Houston. He may be able to get, you know, multi-year deal somewhere else next year. And so that the door is open for him not to stay, but I would like for them to retain him. He's been, you know, probably the best interior pass rusher, if you don't include J.J. Watt, since Antonio Smith was here, and he's, like, the exact thing the Texans needed, you know, when they drafted Ross Blacklock, and they needed, you know, 4 years ago when they decided not to sign interior pass rusher at all whatsoever. That year Brian Gain was fired in the offseason, too. Where do you expect Tim Kelly to go when Houston fires him, working for Bill O'Brien at University of Texas? I would expect for him to join Bill O'Brien somewhere whenever he gets fired. He's the only person he ever coached for his entire career. And I don't watch college football at all, but I'm really excited to watch this Bama-Georgia game on Saturday and have the opportunity to actively root against Bill O'Brien and his stupid offense and everything else that goes along with it. And also, it's just been fun seeing Alabama fans, you know, complain about how bad the coaching has been this year after, you know, with all the talent that they have, offensive and defensively. So watching them go against that Georgia buzzsaw should be fun to do this Saturday. But yeah, I don't know. I would like to see Bill O'Brien anywhere. I think the thing about O'Brien and UT, which is something I joked about, you know, last year, is that the University of Texas needs Bill O'Brien. They're a train wreck. They're a bunch of losers. They're a bunch of guys playing football there who like taking pictures in the jersey, but they don't actually want to play football at all. And, you know, Bill O'Brien could win 8 games a year there. He can go 8-3 every year with the University of Texas. He can get, maybe sometimes he'll go 7-5, whatever else. But he'll be able to take you all to the Cotton Bowl, you know, a few times every year. And then after 5 years, you'll get tired of it and fire him for somebody else. And then you'll be back in this black pit where you can't even, you know, get to that point all whatsoever. So his next question is, can this culture-infused Texans team get to 4 wins in 2021? I picked him to win 4 this year. After losing to the Jets, though, I mean, like, you expect for them to, you know, beat the Jets last week, but lose to the Titans, and that kind of balance it out and put them at 2. And they have, you know, they have a shot maybe against Seattle. They definitely have a shot against the Jaguars. They play the Titans one more time as well. This week they have to play the 49ers again. And this week, of course, they play the Colts. I would say 3 at this point. I don't think they'll beat Tennessee, especially the Titans, who really need to try to secure that 1 seed for the postseason with the injuries that they have. I don't think they beat the Chargers well either. You know, the Seahawks, maybe they can force some turnovers and a little bit of pass rush, but the run defense is so bad. Jacksonville, you know, they should probably be able to beat Jacksonville, I guess, with how poorly that they're coached and the problems that they have with their pass offense too. And San Francisco, they probably lose that game, but I think it's going to be hard for them to get to 4. If they beat the Jets last week, they would have gotten to 4, I think, but I think they have one more win in them. And then they'll end up 3-14 now. Yeah, I hate this stupid 17-game season. I think 3-14 is, I don't know, it's about what's expected for this sort of year. He said, who does Nico Collins remind you of? I think of big wide receivers who get open but are rarely thrown to. You know, Collins, I think, can play. I think he's a quarterback-dependent wide receiver where he's not necessarily going to make life easy for a quarterback. He's not going to be, you know, a consistent chain mover at all. I like him as like a big slot receiver too, where he can run the seam and run some corner routes and make some catches over in traffic over the middle and be able to, you know, pick up some stuff from there as well too. I don't know. I don't have a really good comparison for Collins because I don't want to be like hyperbolic and, you know, compare him to somebody who's like really great. And like trying to think of like an average receiver kind of fits this mold. I don't know. I don't have one at all. But I think Collins can play. I think he just needs a quarterback too. Are you more excited about Burkhead being a 2022 Texan or David Johnson? I mean, it's Burkhead's team, and I don't know. Nick is here talking about Burkhead's, how tough he is in practice and how hard he works in practice is just absurd. That's how they end up getting Burkhead, making him the number one running back on this team now. The David Johnson thing, though, like, you. they've just been so bad admitting failure that, and like he was definitely, I think, kept around. It's like it used to be sort of thing because he has contract restructured. He was bad last year, and I didn't really see like the role for him in this offense at all. And you know, he's been one of the worst running backs in football again this year. I would say Burkhead's been back out of the two, and I would be more excited about Burkhead at this point than Johnson. I think Johnson just needs to, you know, go to the farm upstate and head to the glue factory. His next question is underrated and overrated winter vacations. So usually for me, every MLK weekend, because we get off that Monday, I usually go to Big Bend, and I'll go hike the Aller Mountain Loop. The weather's perfect. It's like 40 degrees at night and like 75 degrees during the day, and the sun's real shiny, and there's not a lot, you have to worry about like, you know, a lot of animals or anything. There's really nobody out there as well either, and that place has really been overcome and kind of devoured by, you know, people wanting to go to that park because it's, you know, beautiful. I've been going there since 2013, and it's just crazy. Like, we would, whenever I first went there was just nobody really there. It was really open. You could just drive up anytime and get campgrounds, and now it's a madhouse, and now, you know, they have Airbnbs that are sold out. They're 100 miles away and that sort of thing. But if you've never been before, it's a perfect park, and it's really, like, you can make it as, like, tough as you want it or as easy as you want it, and they have a little bit of everything, whether it's, like, sitting by the river and reading or walking up to the mountains or putting a blanket down the desert or, you know, walking around the wildflowers or looking at cactuses or the wildlife. It has everything there, and it's a beautiful drive too, and it's very desolate, and it's the night sky park. I'll never forget whenever I spent my first night there. I woke up at like 3:30 in the morning, and the Milky Way was over my head, and we didn't have the rainfall in the tent. And I'd never seen the Milky Way before, and so I woke up and I walked for like an hour just staring at it. It was one of the most spectacular things I've ever seen. So go there. That's an underrated one. Overrated? I don't know. I haven't been on like a ski trip before. But I guess I don't know. I don't really have an overrated one. But good Big Bend. Big Bend's a great place this time of year. So the next questions we have here from my good friend Greg from down in Australia. And he had a question about Josh McDaniels. So he had a question about Josh McDaniels, about staying in Boston long term. So he probably wouldn't be an option for the Texans after talking to one of his friends about the Patriots. But his question is, given the rebuild is likely to be lengthy given the current front office, would the Texans be better off going with a young coach like Kellen Moore, who has long-term potential but will likely make mistakes in the first couple of seasons? And this is a great question, and you know, it's one of those things with David Coley right now, where like I thought for sure he'd be here for, you know, 2 or 3 years or so. At least like until they got the players around and everything needed that, you know, where he could like create like a foundation, this culture that they wanted. Then whenever like a good head coach could come in and take the team and turn it around from there and actually start winning football games. But the mistakes here have just been, you know, so egregious and so outlandish that I don't know. I would not want to see him here next year at all, as much as I love him. But there's just been too much stagnation. There hasn't been enough progression this year, enough development at all either. So I would not want to see him here next year. Whenever it comes to a future head coach for the Texans, you know, I don't really know one at all right now. As far as a young coach option, but I do agree with that though. Like, I think going out and getting somebody who's already has already been somewhere and failed before isn't very helpful. I think they should get somebody who hasn't been head coach before. I think going back to last year too, like, I think Brian Dable would be great. I think Eric Bieniemy would be great. I even think Clint Kubiak would be very funny, just because time's a flat circle and it would kind of be the most Texans thing in the world to do. They're going to hire Clint Kubiak after the Patriots thing fails again and Nick Casario is fired and everything else. They'll go get Clint. They'll get Gary as like an assistant GM or something like that, and we'll be able to have the exact same team and, you know, 2031 that we, you know, love so much, 10 years ago now. So, I agree with that line of thinking. I think they'd be better off getting, like, a younger guy who has a spongier brain, who's more flexible, who will take more chances and miss, who will kind of grow into the job as well, too. Then, you know, just take, like, another veteran head coach who's been there before, like a Doug Peterson or something like that. Like, I'd rather see a younger guy who may have the ability to kind of do something with it. I think Zach Taylor is a good example of that. And same thing with Cliff Kingsbury. Like Taylor, like I didn't know if he was a good coach or not. And entering year three, you know, he's shown a big change where they stopped running all those stupid empty sets where they had a ton of pass protection issues in those. Drafting Chase was the right decision. They're a really good shotgun team. They have a really good outside zone game. Their offense is really well balanced. It attacks every level of the field. Burrow has, you know, great feet. He has a great mobility in the pocket. He sees the game really well, even though he doesn't have a whole lot of arm strength at all. He still had a lot of success throughout it just because of how well the structure of the offense has been and, you know, his own ability to process the game like that too. And then, like, you know, Kingsbury also, like, he wasn't a good head coach last year. He wasn't a good head coach the year before that. And, you know, this year he's kind of really corrected a lot of the mistakes that he had as a play caller by having an offense that was more than Kyler Murray scrambles and DeAndre Hopkins curl routes. That was an offense that didn't run so many stupid running plays out of, you know, spread formation. They only got 2 yards and kind of killed the offense. And this year he turned Colt McCoy into an efficient passer where everything was less than 5 yards, you know. He was able to get more wide receivers involved and create a really well-balanced attack. He turned James Conner into a red zone machine. Their offensive line has played a lot better as well, too. And so I do think any younger guy like that who can grow into the job be better than, you know, hiring some sort of retread as well, too. His next question was regarding Bill Belichick. Why is the greatest coach of all time produce such bad head coaches? And I think with Belichick, it really is. He's just so good at it, I guess, that he doesn't delegate as much. Or, like, he has everybody in very specific roles where they're not able to, I think, branch out, understand the entirety of the game. And also, like, it's his team, too. I think that's a lot of it also. And we have a head coach that's good, and that is that good. You don't have to, like, have your other coaches, I guess, like, have as much responsibility and have as much say in things. I think they kind of like a limited, you know, viewpoint because of it. So it is weird, though. It's like you would say Brian Flores is probably the only good one he's had. And Flores was a team that only had one win for a long part of the season. He's just gone on a 3-game win streak where they were starting through a lot of RPOs down to his back. Some they did whenever he did before he got hurt. And they kind of found their roots against the high blitz defense. And they forced more turnovers during their win streak than they did when they found themselves, you know, 1-7 or whatever it was as well, too. His last question was about would Josh McDaniels be a good fit for the Texans, and he kind of retracted that statement in a second email. But, like, again, it's the same thing. Like, no New England coaches. And the rumor with McDaniels, too, as he said in his other email, is that he's in line to be the next Patriots head coach probably once Belichick steps down. And it's the only thing that makes sense for why he turned down the Indy job like he did, too. And, like, he's done a really good job this year. He's done the best job out of any of the offensive coaches at building an offense around his rookie quarterback. It's a short middle of field passing offense that takes some shots off of play action. There's a really well designed run attack, and it's a perfect offense for Mac Jones. And that's the reason why he's had so much success. Where he's making, you know, a lot of these throws are open, and, like, the key to Mac Jones is to get interior pressure and make him throw mistakes after pressure. And maybe the Bills can do that this week in an enormous AFC East game. So our next question is from my friend Chad. And he asks, if Taylor hadn't been injured in the second game of the season, do you think the Texans are in a different place in standings now? Or do you really think it would have made that much of a difference? I don't think so at all. And, like, maybe they win one more game, maybe two more games, and they have 4 wins instead of 2 wins. But I just don't really... Taylor's just, like, he's very average, and this year he's been below average, and Tim Kelly offense stuff hasn't worked as well either. And I don't know. I don't think it really made much of a difference, though. I think the biggest difference, though, is, like, the Texans were unwatchable with Davis Mills, and recently this week there's a lot of clamoring for Davis Mills to come in, which I don't really see why. Like, he was unplayable, you know, with them, where he's running 5 route concepts, and that's it. And I know the numbers are kind of similar to Taylor, and it really is just because he had that fluky New England game he hasn't been able to replicate at all, where 2 of those throws he'll probably never make again whatsoever. And, you know, Taylor's been, you know, really bad since he came back from his hamstring injury too. But I don't think it makes that much of a difference with Taylor being here or not. It just makes the Texans, like, watchable. You know, you can watch a really stupid game instead of a game where they lose by, you know, 21 points and don't really have a chance at all whatsoever. And so our last question is from @FoundOfHOUSports. Yes. Also, what is COVID toe to you? Your thoughts on Aaron Rodgers' recent PR campaign? Yeah, I've turned around on Aaron Rodgers. I think, like his, I talked about it with Mike Meltzer when he was on the show. I think like his press conference that he did on the McAfee show was just like he had all the bullet points of things that make people upset about the COVID stuff online, and he hit every single one of them. The whole checklist. He brought up ivermectin, brought up Joe Rogan, brought up his own research, brought up, the semantics between immunity and vaccinated, and, everything else as well, too. And so I think he, I don't know, it was just like, I thought it was hilarious, and how he kind of knew exactly what he was doing and pulled it off. And also, he's a dick, And I really have enjoyed how much of a dick he is this year, especially with that win against the Rams. And some of these throws have been outrageous too. And the Packers have such a balanced attack also. And it's hilarious that the NFC is going to go through AJ Dillon this year as well too. As far as COVID toe though, and him showing his foot up to the camera, I think it kind of goes along with that. He's older. This may be his last year in Green Bay. He's kind of proved everything already. I think he's just kind of having fun with the spot he's in, and maybe next year he ends up in Denver or San Francisco or wherever else it may possibly be after the Packers. Drafted Love, and we saw him this year, and I guess he's a real quarterback, but that was one of the worst performances we've seen so far this year as well too. So anyway, that's the mailbag for tonight. I'm sorry that I didn't get to these questions sooner. I kind of wanted to do this once a week, but life happens and time happens, and this is not a full-time gig for me at all by any means, and so I do the best I can to keep everything going, but I'll ask for questions on Sunday. I think next week we'll have Texans Cap on the show, and I'll finally get some answers about this post-June 1st nonsense that I've always wondered why it's set up like that. I never have done the time to find out. Well, this week I'm actually going to find out, and I believe we'll do the show on Monday night to review the Texans-Colts game from last week, because it should be fun, though. The games are bad. The team is bad. Everything's pretty dumb, but at least we have each other, and we can make things enjoyable out of it. And, we're Texans fans, and this is what we're accustomed to. This is the life we've always lived, and it's the life we'll continue to live for the foreseeable future. So until next, one last thing. I should have said this in the beginning, but if you subscribe to the podcast, if Battle Red Radio is in your top five on Spotify podcast play, send me a DM, send me your address, and I'll have something very special for you this holiday season. I know exactly when to get you. I don't know who you are, if you're going to send me a message or not, or who's going to send me a message, but I already know I'm going to get you, and it should be something that you'll love and cherish forever. So send me some messages with your addresses. I want to send some presents out this year, and that's all I got for tonight. So until next time, I'm Matt Weston. Thank you for listening to Battle Red Radio, and thank you for all your beautiful questions.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prop G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Gara Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from blue flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. Not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday, and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds four times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.